Matter podcast. I'm your host, Nick Jacomas, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Luke Van Loon. Luke is a professor of physiology, the physiology of exercise and nutrition in the Netherlands. And this is the second time I've had him on the podcast on an episode I'll link to in the episode description, all about exercise, science, physiology, dietary nutrients, and how those relate to physical activity. And in this conversation, we focused on some new research he's done, and it had to do with dietary protein and muscle growth. So Dr. Van Loon is an expert about muscle physiology, how the body utilizes things like dietary proteins and other types of nutrients. We talked about amino acids, essential versus non-essential amino acids. We talked about branched chain amino acids. We talked about how amino acids are not only building blocks for proteins, but some of them are also signaling molecules in the body. They bind to receptors and regulate information pathways that regulate how our tissues grow and respond to physical activity. We talked about plant versus animal-based protein sources and whether or not those are different, how they affect things like muscle growth. And we talked about some recent research that his lab has done that looks at how much protein you can consume to fuel muscle growth in the body. So for example, if you eat, you know, say 25 versus 100 grams of protein, how are those going to affect muscle growth in the body differently? Is there a maximum amount of protein you can eat each day or in each meal before the gains you get in muscle growth max out? Or is more protein consumption going to translate to more muscle growth? We talked about how the muscles actually incorporate amino acids from the body, from the diet. We talked about amino acid recycling in the body and how much and how often that's occurring. So if you're interested in amino acid biology, muscle physiology, how dietary proteins from different sources get incorporated into the body, and how exercise and resistance training fuel muscle growth in the body, and how all of the biology underlying that works, this is a really interesting episode. Dr. Van Loon is, you know, arguably the world's top expert on this stuff. He has published a lot on exercise science and diet and things like that. This is a really fascinating episode. He is one of my favorite people to follow when it comes to this stuff. Don't forget to check out the Mind and Matter Substack, mindandmatter.substack.com. That is linked in the episode description. You will also find some links to my affiliate partners. I partner with a few different companies. These are all products that I use in my own life, mainly health and wellness related. I would recommend checking those out. If you make any purchases through those links, you will get a discount, and I get a little bit of that money, which I use to help keep the podcast going and growing. So all of your help there is appreciated. And with that, here's my conversation with Dr. Luke Van Loon. It seems like you've been on fire with lots of publications the last year or so.
Oh, I think that's the publications. Actually, it's as normal, but I think this one got a lot of attention, by which it seems that we're publishing more. But I think we've always been publishing, but mostly we do not. I mean, I do not tend to send it to high impact journals, because I generally prefer to send it either to the exercise people or the nutrition people. So they often come up in lower impact journals, which doesn't mean the quality is anything less or that. But Jorn Trommelen, who is the lead author of this, really wanted to send it off at a high impact journal. He's young and ambitious. I've already lost that stage of doing that. That's why you got a lot of attention.
Do you feel like you actually get better reviews, higher quality reviews, when you send it to more like specialty journals rather than, you know, the top tier sexy big name journals?
I think a lot of the higher impact journals is a lot of who knows who. And also a lot of combination studies where, for example, human and animal work and a lot of cell work are combined. And sometimes that makes sense for some studies. For some studies, it absolutely doesn't make sense, because sometimes those three models are not, they do not necessarily align.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's probably a lot of ways that, you know, a mouse's metabolism works very differently than a human's. And if you try and compare them, you're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole.
Yeah, one major problem that you have, for example, we got this question a lot, that, for example, we show, for example, protein synthesis or amino acid uptake or perfusion or anything that is directly measurable as a dynamic measure, like muscle protein synthesis over the last few hours, blood glucose uptake or release from the liver. stuff like that that we do with stable isotopes that gives you a real physiological signal of a process that is ongoing. And then often we get the responses like, oh, you haven't shown a mechanism. And then I say, I'm just thinking like, we've just shown you the mechanism, because that is the effect it has on glucose uptake, blood perfusion, protein synthesis, whatever. And then what they want to see is, for example, a whole scala of mRNAs or Western blots of phosphorylation of specific proteins. And to be honest, I'm not very in favor of that, because it only gives you a snapshot of what happens at a certain point in time, because that's only one biopsy at one time point that shows you light X is on, light Y is off. That doesn't give me any mechanism. It gives me only an insight that there are a few proteins that might be relevant or have a relationship in the process that I was looking for. So I'm always a little bit pissed off when I hear somebody saying like, you have to do molecular signaling in order to get a mechanism. That's absolutely not what I think.
Yeah, I mean, what you're speaking to, I think, is it's a pretty deep problem, in that what you're really saying is the language scientists use, we often use language in different ways. So, you know, when a molecular biologist says mechanism and they have a background in transcription, they want to see gene expression patterns. When someone like you says mechanism, you have something different in mind. And people often sort of, frankly, when people ask for mechanism, oftentimes, not always, certainly, but oftentimes it's kind of just a lazy assessment saying, yeah, just show me what I'm familiar with.
And so the main thing that we do, and that's not because we're preaching for our own ministry, but we use a lot of stable isotopes. And why? Because we can see the dynamics in a process, and nothing in the body is regulated on a simple concentration. Everything is regulated on changes in uptake, release, stuff like that. And that's why we love to use stable isotope tracers and measure the dynamics of muscle physiology or whole body physiology. And what is always funny is then you still have to think, because one of the nice examples that we have is, for example, that I always try to teach the students is, for example, if you ingest glucose, like an oral glucose tolerance test, your glucose concentration goes up and then it goes down again. And always give people the example, what happens now if you add fiber, non-digestible, non-metabolizable fiber to the glucose? Then everybody naturally will say, okay, you get less of an increase in glucose concentration, it attenuates, and then actually goes down again. So you get a little more blunted glucose response. Agree? So what is your conclusion then? If you see a study and you see a blunted glucose response with fiber added to glucose, what is your conclusion of this experiment?
Probably less glucose was absorbed, or less insulin was secreted, the fiber sort of getting in the way.
Fiber delays glucose uptake into the body. Yeah? So can actually find hundreds of studies in the literature. Now I do the same thing, but then I do the following. Give an amount of glucose, concentration goes up, goes down again. Now I perform 1 hour of exercise before I ingest glucose. I get, again, a blunted glucose response. What is your conclusion then?
So yeah, you're saying you can get the same dynamic pattern, but the body's obviously doing something very different with the glucose in each case.
You have the outcome that is exactly the same, but your explanation conclusion is 180 degrees the opposite.
One of them you're going to
conclude. Fiber delays the digestion and absorption, and therefore the rate of appearance of glucose coming into the circulation. And exercise accelerates the uptake of glucose from the circulation, so the rate of disappearance from the circulation is increased. It's a complete different mechanism, completely different physiological process, but the endpoint in concentrations is the same. And that's where tracers come in handy, because then you know whether it's the rate of appearance of glucose into the circulation that is attenuated, or whether it's the uptake of glucose from the circulation that is increased. Mm-hmm. That's why we like to study these things.
Yeah. So, you guys have done a lot of work with these tracers. So you can see not only the temporal dynamics of things as they change when you take blood samples and things, but you can also end up seeing like where do the things go in the body? Are they actually being taken up more or what?
Released more or taken up more. And then preferably, if we also manage to sample the different organs or tissues, we can also say where it's going. And that gives you much more insight in what is really happening in the body.
And so
I like the other example. If your glucose level and my glucose level, hopefully, is about 6 millimoles per liter now. If we start cycling now, our glucose flux in the body increases several folds, but our glucose concentrations hopefully stay exactly the same. So your concentrations in the blood don't tell you anything what is happening, and certainly not where it is happening.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of today's discussion is going to center around what the body does with protein, what it does with amino acids. When we eat high protein diets, different amounts of protein after exercise. A lot of it will center on a paper that we'll eventually talk about, but I want to just talk about some basic background stuff to get started. So when we talk about eating protein, traditionally speaking, for a normal, healthy person, what would be considered like a high protein meal or an average protein meal in terms of how many grams of protein you might ingest at lunch or at dinner or something like that?
A modest meal would be about 20 grams of protein. If you have an evening dinner with some meat, you easily go up to 40 grams. Mm-hmm. So somewhere in between for an average meal of an average male adult of about 70 to 80 kilograms.
So roughly speaking, in that range, that would be the amount of protein, very roughly speaking, that someone, a normal person, is eating to sort of just maintain their body composition. How might that compare to someone who is intentionally trying to build muscle and is doing a lot of resistance training and is eating, quote unquote, a lot of protein on purpose? How much might they be targeting?
Yeah, so if we talk not about a meal, but about daily protein intake, then of course the World Health Organization says that we need to consume 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram body mass per day. Most of us consume 1 to 1.2 grams of protein per kilogram body mass per day, normal people, everyday people that you see on the street. If you are very active and you're exercising a lot, even if you're not particularly interested in protein, you consume more food. If you consume more food, and generally 10 to 15% of your energy that you consume comes from protein, then you easily go up to 1.3, 1.4. And of course, if you're an athlete with a very high activity level, and or you also consume protein supplements, they often go from 1.4 to even well above 2. Mm-hmm. That's not said that it's required. That's the last thing now I would say.
And what has traditionally been the different ways of thinking about how much protein is enough and how much is too much? What are some of the parameters here that people think about when they think about healthy amounts of protein to eat?
Yeah, so normally on a daily basis, it's somewhere between 10 to 15 energy percent coming from protein is sufficient. But if, as I said, if you're physically active and you eat and consume a lot more energy, you automatically consume an excess amount of protein. So the minimal amount, which I do not say it's the optimal amount, would be the 0.8 or 0.78 grams of protein per kilogram body mass per day, as the World Health Organization advises. But of course, I think more ideal would be around 1 to 1.2. Now, one of the reasons is what we now think, or what the literature has shown in the past, is that you get an anabolic response following the ingestion of about 20 grams of protein, high quality protein, when you are a healthy adult. And so the assumption is that with every main meal, you get an anabolic response that basically balances the overnight negative response, and then you can be in netto balance, net protein balance throughout 24 hours. And so if you have three main meals or four main meals, depending, you basically have three or four times, say, 25 grams of protein, which is around 75 grams of protein, which is about 1 gram per kilogram body mass per day. So every meal, preferably consuming about 25 grams of protein.
And you said high quality protein there. What exactly do you mean by high quality protein, and how do we think about protein quality?
Yeah, so that's a discussion that we would have if we would start talking about plant-based proteins, of course. So that's I can actually make that into a two-hour lecture, so we don't have that time. But protein quality is, you can actually define it in three different levels. One is digestibility, availability of the protein for the human body. So that depends largely on how the protein is packaged, not packaged in a factory, but by nature. So if you have, for example, plant-based proteins, a lot of the protein does not become available because it's more difficult for the human body to extract by protein digestion and absorption. So first factor is digestibility. Now, much of the research that I and my colleagues do is often with plant-based proteins that are derived from plant-based foods. So that's protein isolates and concentrates. Think protein powders. Mm-hmm. Then the digestibility is already very high. Then you have the rate of digestion and absorption. Proteins that are more rapidly digested and absorbed allow more of the amino acids to be released in the circulation, and they tend to have a higher anabolic response because you have a faster increase in circulating essential amino acids, which drive the anabolic response to feeding. And the third one is the amino acid composition. A lot of the lower quality proteins have either a lower essential amino acid content, and often they are deficient in one or more specific amino acids. Notorious is that a lot of the plant-based proteins can be deficient in methionine or lysine. And often they're also very low in leucine. But of course, it's not for every plant-based proteins because there's a lot of different ones. Mm-hmm. But those are the three things that define the quality of a protein. And then, of course, if you ask different people, quality depends on functionality, of course. If you ask an immunologist what he thinks of quality, that is something else than you ask, for example, a muscle physiologist who studies muscle protein synthesis. Mm. But from a protein synthesis point of view, it's digestibility, rate of digestion, and amino acid absorption kinetics, and the amino acid composition.
Mm-hmm. And I want to spend a little time talking about some of the different types of amino acids. So as many listeners will know, amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. One of the distinctions to be made between the different types is essential versus non-essential. So the essential amino acids we need to acquire from diet because we can't produce them endogenously. But there are other differences too. One that I'm interested in hearing about is branched chain amino acids. What are those and how are they sort of unique or special?
So the branched chain amino acids, those are three amino acids. It's leucine, isoleucine, and valine. And of course, I think leucine is the most well-known to most people listening, is that leucine is one of the strongest amino acids that signal towards the anabolic pathway, the mTOR pathway. So we believe nowadays that leucine is one of the most important components that drives the increase in muscle protein synthesis when you ingest protein. Of course, it's probably not only leucine, it's also the interaction with other amino acids. And what people should never forget is that it's only the signaling response. So if you ingest a protein, you see an increase in circulating essential amino acids and non-essential amino acids in the blood. They actually trigger the muscle to activate anabolic pathways, such as the mTOR pathway. Leucine plays an important role in that. But it's likely that there's also an interaction with other amino acids. But even if you stimulate that whole signaling pathway, you still need all the amino acids as building blocks to be available to support a higher muscle protein synthesis. And that is something that we don't know everything about, because to what extent is a certain amino acid limiting the postprandial after a meal increase in muscle protein synthesis?
Mm. I see. So some amino acids, so all of these amino acids that we typically talk about, leucine and others, they're used as building blocks of proteins, but some of them are additionally signaling molecules, meaning that they're binding to receptors, changing gene expression and the behavior of cells, what the cells are actually doing with the materials that we feed them.
Yep. And then they also have an interaction with directly on the beta cells in your pancreas in stimulating insulin. But insulin is in the acute postprandial muscle protein synthetic response to feeding. Sorry for that long sentence. Insulin is a permissive hormone and not a stimulatory, but it's still part of the process.
I see. So you can glucose is not the only way to stimulate insulin.
We've done studies in the past. What's really cool is to show that, for example, in diabetics, you can still get a very strong insulin response, even though their response to glucose is attenuated. So if you give them glucose, there's hardly an insulin response anymore, but you give them glucose together with amino acids and you still have quite a normal response. So a lot of the issues with signaling in the pancreas or in the beta cell is triggered by not only glucose, but also amino acids and also the interaction between the two.
What about, I hear sometimes about atypical amino acids. So things like taurine, which aren't used as building blocks for proteins, but are still amino acids.
Yeah, sometimes there was an interesting paper suggesting that taurine is a very important factor, or a relevant factor that is a sort of biological marker for age. Now I'm pretty critical about that. I don't believe it, but we are now actually. So normally when we do a full amino acid assay in blood, we actually don't even look at taurine. But nowadays, we actually put it in our screening as well to see whether we see any evidence of that. But that will be the next few years that we collect data and actually look at taurine.
Interesting. So I think you're referring to, so this is actually work that I've covered on the podcast before. So taurine is an atypical amino acid. It's found in certain foods. It's not used as a building block for proteins, but people have correlated it with aging, meaning it tends to go down with age in all different animals that you look at. And when people, the basic result that has been shown not so long ago was that they were able to supplement animal diets, worms, flies, monkeys, or rodents at least. They were supplementing animals with taurine and basically seeing a life extension effect. You're saying that there might be more to the puzzle than that.
I don't know whether there's more, but there's less to the puzzle. So we see a lot of these studies that we can't reproduce. But time is on our side. Let's just see what happens. And I would like to see, for example, in the older populations that we have, whether we see a change, for example, in taurine, when we mobilize older people and they become more trained. We've done that in the past with different omics techniques to show that from a transcriptomics perspective, you can actually differentiate between an old muscle and a young muscle, or a muscle, a piece of muscle from an older person versus a younger person. But then the difference is quite clear. But then if you start exercising these older people, suddenly the profile is no longer differential. You can't actually see the difference anymore. So a lot of the differences that we see between young and old in protein synthesis, in anabolic resistance, in transcriptomic profile in the muscle is often lifestyle related.
I see. So it can be an artifact of lifestyle rather than an aging related thing per se.
Yes. For example, you know that in muscle you have type 1 and type 2 fibers. Now, in younger people, especially if they also do some resistance exercise, the type 2 fiber is always bigger than the type 1 fiber. Now, if you become older, we know that especially the type 2 fibers get smaller. So even if the muscle fibers are exactly the same and you take a biopsy from an older and a younger person, then because of the type 2 fibers are smaller, you will actually have relatively more type 1 fiber in the older adult than in the younger adult. So that would already induce a response or a difference. So this is one of the reasons why aging research is often easier in animals, because you can't compare only age per se.
Yeah,
if you compare young and older people, you compare lifestyle, comorbidities, co-medication, comorbidities, all of these other things, and also changes in the muscle that occur.
Yeah, that makes sense. You're naturally going to have a different lifestyle as you age, sometimes for aging related reasons, but sometimes for other reasons. As you were just saying, if the tissue composition itself changes and you're not controlling for those changes, then you've got a confound there that you may not be taking into account. When we think about protein, like I want to give people a sense for like what happens to protein as we eat it, and then it gets incorporated into our bodies. So let's just say, I sit down for a meal, I eat some steak, something with high protein content that has a good amino acid profile, good digestibility. Can you give people a bird's eye view for what is happening in the breakdown process going from the stomach into the GI tract and ultimately getting incorporated into your tissues?
Now, that's great that you asked that question, because that's the main thing that I'm interested in. And that's the reason why we actually started infusing cows with labeled amino acids, etc. We'll come to that later probably, so that we can actually follow that process from beginning to end. So if you ingest a simple meal, it generally contains about 20 grams of protein. Those 20 grams of protein will be broken down into smaller pieces from your gastric and your gut to your intestine. Then you will actually get di and tripeps and oligopeptides, so smaller chains of amino acids. They will be further dissected into smaller amino acids. Most of the amino acids will be absorbed by the intestinal lumen in the form of free amino acids. A lot of them will actually be retained in the intestinal tissues, also for the turnover of the gut. About, depending on whether you have a rapidly digestible protein or a slowly digestible protein, between 50 and 80% of the amino acids will actually go through the portal vein after the gastrointestinal tract, through the liver, into the circulation. And there they're actually flowing around. Your meal also has an effect on your insulin release. So your pancreas releases some insulin. What insulin does is it opens up the vascular beds. So all your blood vessels, at least in the insulin sensitive tissues, which include muscle. So those amino acids that have just entered the circulation will flow through the muscle. The muscle will see those amino acids, will be taking those amino acids up. Somewhere in that process, all those signaling pathways are switched on, stimulating mRNA translation, protein synthesis is increased, and if lucky, you have all the available building blocks to build the protein that you want. Depending on what you've done the last, say, 24 hours before that meal, you will actually synthesize proteins. If you've done the resistance exercise, you'll build actin and myosin to become a, like, say, a bodybuilder type. If you've done, for example, a lot of endurance type exercise, you might be building all components of mitochondria that allow you to oxidize a lot of fat. So a lot of people always, there's a big mistake in the literature that people pick protein synthesis as muscle building. No, it's reconditioning. It's conditioning of your muscle, refurbishing of your muscle towards where you want it to be. It's not necessarily muscle accretion.
When we eat that protein, we break down to the amino acids, our body absorbs all that. How much of the protein synthesis that's happening, how much of the muscle reconditioning and the refurbishing, how much of that is coming from the amino acids that we ate in our last meal versus are there amino acids stored for later use? Like how much can we have in the bank and not be dependent on diet?
Probably one of the reasons why I was happy to come back on the podcast, because you're asking these questions, that makes sense. So the interesting thing is that if you imagine that on a daily basis, all of us synthesize about 300 grams of protein. And that is muscle, that is brain, that is kidney, that is enzymes, that is hormones, anything. Acute phase proteins, 300 grams of protein. Now, we just discussed the amount of protein that we consume on a daily basis, say 1 gram of per kilogram body mass per day. So when you're 70 or 75, 75 grams, say 75 grams. So we make 300 grams and we ingest only 75 grams to stay in balance. That means we are recycling 225 grams of protein on a daily basis. So a lot of the response after a meal is actually taking part of the amino acids from what you ingested, but also a lot of the amino acids that were actually released from tissues breaking down. So it's really cool to see that we're constantly refurbishing our tissues. And what is an amino acid now in your brain might be one in your left toe in an hour from now or tomorrow morning. It's really amazing how that works. And you can actually see that online, basically, if you take these tissues.
I see. So, you know, when we think of, you know, oftentimes when we think about protein and diet and exercise, we think of getting progressively bigger muscles. And it's probably natural for a lot of people to think of, like, you know, you have your muscle that you have right now. It's built out of the amino acids that are in there. And we're going to sort of stack things on top of that. What you're saying is it's actually constantly, all of it is constantly turning over and it's much more dynamic.
And that's why it's so, I still find it magical to see that if you ingest 20 grams of protein, that you see muscle protein synthesis being increased. Because in the total, now we come back to tracers, in the total dynamics of the system, that 25 grams is nothing.
Mm.
Because there's actually fivefold more amino acids being released into the circulation, and about 80% of the amino acids released in the circulation is not coming from your gut. So it's only that little extra 20% spark in amino acids coming from the gut that is actually setting up that whole response to a meal. But there's a lot of other amino acids constantly being released into the circulation.
Hmm. So if someone's eating 75 grams of protein a day on average, typical person, but you have, 300 grams per day of turnover, and a lot of that just comes from recycling the protein that's already inside of you. How does that relate to the idea of excess dietary amino acids and consuming too much amino acids? How do you start to think about that?
Yeah, so at some point you will, if you ingest too much protein or more than you need, you'll start oxidizing it. That might be some futile protein synthetic cycle. We don't really know where that is, what that is. We also to make things easier, we tell ourselves that the muscle tissue or the tissue-free amino acid pool is stable and very small. We always say that. I've never seen really clear proof of that. So temporarily, you can actually get much of an increase in amino acids in the free pool in the different tissues. But from a regulatory point of view, that can't be too long, because then it's dysregulating the whole metabolism. So most of them, at some point, will be oxidized.
And I don't know much about this area, but I know that there's a lot to learn here. Oxidized amino acids, are they bad for you? Do we want to minimize the amount of oxidized amino acids? How does that work?
No, I mean, if you actually ingest a large amount of protein, you can oxidize it just as well as that you can oxidize carbohydrates and fats. The only reason is that it's actually very costly to convert them and oxidize them. So that is one of the reasons why, besides the fact that proteins in the diet are also satiating, is that this high protein diet often helps in losing weight. Both by restricting food intake and also because of the conversion to fat is actually more energy demanding.
Mm, I see. So gram for gram, if you're eating a high protein diet compared to a lower protein diet, you're basically making your body do more metabolic work. So yep, it becomes exactly easier to burn calories.
Yep.
Interesting. And at some point, is there a clear line or do people have different opinions about, what excess actually means when we talk about excess amino acids? Is too much actually becoming clearly unhealthy at some point in terms of promoting aging or promoting excess growth beyond what the body actually needs?
Yeah, this is always a little bit of an issue. I always get so we're talking about older people, for example, and often they do not consume enough protein. And then we suggest that they should consume more protein, and everybody gets worried and saying like, hey, might that actually induce some risks? For example, kidney damage and stuff like that. There's no evidence for that at all. But the biggest thing is, do realize that sometimes you hear people talking about high protein expressed from a relative point of view. And sometimes you hear people talking about high protein from an absolute point of view.
Mm.
So imagine, for example, a Tour de France cyclist. He might consume on a busy day 25 megajoules of energy, up to even more than 30 megajoules of energy on a daily basis. They don't consume huge amounts of protein-rich foods, because a lot of it is carbohydrate, as you know. So if they consume, they probably consume well below 10% of their diet from protein. But then just calculate yourself. This is the homework for the viewers and the listeners. 30 megajoules of energy, kilojoules. So 10% is protein. How much protein that actually is. So they consume a diet that is low in protein, but their absolute protein intake is more than 2.5 grams per kilogram body mass per day.
Mm-hmm.
So differentiate between high protein in an absolute amount and high protein in a relative amount. Now, I don't see any problems with a high protein diet in a relative amount. And on an absolute amount, it depends on your energy intake and energy expenditure. And if people are in energy balance, I don't see big issues there at all.
I see. So if you're in energy balance, you're eating an appropriate amount of food for how much physical activity you're engaged in. You said you don't see a problem with the relative amount of protein, meaning, you know, if you're eating a high percentage of your calories as protein, as opposed to a higher percentage as another type of nutrient.
Yeah, within the normal limits, of course, with foods. I mean, and then you're between between 5 and 25.
And is this like a controversial area? Because I feel like I hear a lot, and some of it's from science people and some of it's from other types of people commenting on the science. So I don't know how much truth gets lost along the way. There do seem to be quite a lot of people out there saying you should really limit protein intake. It can have detrimental effects if it gets too high, even in relative terms.
Yeah. So, and I see and hear these things all the time for also fats and also for carbohydrates. And also in the relationship of, for example, mechanisms to induce insulin resistance. Sometimes you hear that amino acids can induce insulin resistance, fatty acids can induce insulin resistance, and glucose can also induce insulin resistance. I always explain to the students basically saying that if the milkman comes by with 2 bottles of milk every day and you only drink one, then it's not going to take a week before you start calling him to bring you only one bottle. That's insulin resistance. So if you actually infuse any macronutrients, or glucose, free fatty acids, or an amino acid in the circulation, and the tissues can't actually process that anymore, then they will probably say, I don't want more. That's insulin resistance. That's not necessarily pathology. So yes, amino acids can induce insulin resistance, but yes, glucose as well and fatty acids as well. So every excess of a nutrient can induce insulin resistance and therefore anabolic resistance, et cetera, et cetera. So much of it is simply energy balance. As long as we are in energy balance, things cannot or can hardly go wrong. It's the problem when we get excess foods and then the body has difficulty handling it. Then you get ectopic lipid deposition, you develop insulin resistance, et cetera. And those are all ways of the body to adapt to a disbalance in your energy intake and energy expenditure.
And how do we, so do we think about excess at the level of calories or at the level of different macronutrients? Because I know a lot of people emphasize that, you know, you can still get insulin resistance, you can still get obesity, even if you're not in positive energy balance. So in other words, you know, I've had people on the podcast emphasize that, you know, two people can consume the same amount of calories, but get very different metabolic outcomes or levels of fat deposition or insulin resistance because some specific nutrients are having an outsized effect on the insulin piece of this or the fat synthesis piece of this, et cetera.
Yes, but I've never seen a study that convinced me that if you ingest food in energy balance, it makes you obese. I don't think that's possible, simply.
So being in positive energy balance is necessary for that.
No, I mean, yes, to be obese, you have to be in a positive energy balance. I mean, this is the same thing like I've heard so many, I've actually been asked a question about food intake restriction and time restricted feeding or intermittent fasting, all those different popular terms. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people not in science, and I mean, even myself, if I apply intermittent fasting, I lose a lot of fat. What I basically do, I don't live too healthy, so I basically consume probably about 70% of all my energy after 7 o'clock in the evening. Because in the morning, I run to the lab. I spend most of the time at work not having time to eat or not thinking about eating. And in the evening, I'm sitting to revise papers and trying to think about stuff and being stressed out about grant applications and stuff like that. And then I start eating behind my computer. So if I do intermittent fasting and I decide only to eat between 8 o'clock in the morning and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, then I will still eat very little. But then if I don't eat between 6 o'clock in the evening and 12 o'clock going to bed, it means that I actually restrict more than 70% of my energy intake. Of course, I'm going to lose a lot of weight. Mm. Plus, I'm also going to omit not eating a lot of unhealthy foods. But we've also done studies where we compare intermittent fasting when we consume exactly the same foods in a standardized, balanced way at different time points. Then we don't see any difference. We see exactly the same. If it's in a hypercaloric diet, we see exactly the same weight loss.
I see. So if you actually control, so this gets to a point, you know, I've heard others make, which is that if you're doing, so what you're saying, if I'm hearing you correctly, tell me if this is a good translation. Mm-hmm. In other words, if someone loses weight because they're doing daily intermittent fasting, it's not the time restriction per se. It's that doing that time restriction has helped them actually consume fewer overall calories.
Yes, in combination with also maybe stimulating them to exercise more, to be more active. Mm-hmm. There's also some very nice studies from Bath showing that if you skip breakfast, you tend to be less active throughout the day. So there's also an interaction between eating, having eaten, and being physically active from an habitual point of view.
I see. Besides the calorie side of this, just the calories in and turning that into fat piece of this, the obesity piece, is there any benefit to time-restricted feeding in terms of inflammation markers or other aspects of physiology?
Oh, temporarily, I think it could. I mean, but in the long run, I don't think it makes that much of a difference. I mean, you can use it to, I mean, you know that athletes, for example, like to do long endurance type exercise sessions in the morning before breakfast in order to maximize fat oxidation. So that is the way how with diet, you can play around with optimizing adaptive responses to exercise. For example, if you want to do intermittent high-intensity exercise, you're not going to do that in the morning in an overnight fasted state because then you won't actually reach that normal exercise intensity. So yes, you can work with diet and physical activity to moderate acute physiology and acute metabolism. And that can help you benefit from different, but it depends on your aims, your targets, and what you want to achieve.
And when we think about muscle, and building muscle, we can think about a bodybuilder, we can think about a different type of athlete. I imagine based on what you've told me and what's out there in the literature, people have probably had lots of different opinions about how much protein is a good amount, the time course that you eat it on. Should you be eating it spread out 3 meals a day? Should you be eating it right before a workout and things like that? Can you give us sort of a bird's eye view of the different ways of thinking about that that sort of set us up to discuss your recent study?
Yep. So people have shown that they started with infusing amino acids, then they started with ingesting free amino acids, and after that, more studies were doing ingestion of certain amounts of protein, and they show you that you get an increase in muscle protein synthesis for up to about 5 hours after ingesting a single bolus of protein or free amino acids. And that has led us to believe that every main meal with sufficient protein stimulates muscle protein synthesis for, say, up to 4 to 6 hours. And that if you do that 3 times a day, you basically balance out a negative overnight protein balance, and then you're in balance or in maintenance over 24 hours. So that's the reason why nowadays people are being advised to ingest about 20 grams of more protein with each main meal, dispersed nicely over the day. And for example, for more active athletes, going up to 4 or 5 meals a day, also nicely distributed throughout the day. That is the basis on the individual studies that showed us that a single meal leads to an anabolic response.
So if that was sound, in other words, if you were a bodybuilder and you had the choice between eating 4 25-gram protein meals versus 100-gram protein meal, most people up until recently would have said spread it out.
Yes, because the suggestion was that if you ingest more than that 25 grams, then most of it will be oxidized.
Mm. Got it. And so What was this recent study that you guys did? What was the basic setup?
So where do we start? So we like to measure not only muscle protein synthesis, but also the digestion of protein, the absorption of the amino acids, the release in the circulation, so that we can also see what happens with the food that you ingest. Completely going back to the question you asked, how many of the amino acids that are incorporated into protein after a meal are actually coming from the last meal you ingested? Mm-hmm. So that is stuff that we want to know. And in order to do that, we do not only infuse labeled amino acid traces in the circulation, but we also ingest labeled amino acids that are incorporated into milk protein. And you can't commercially buy that stuff. So the only way of doing that is actually making it yourself. Now, making it ourselves is not completely true because we have the help of a cow. So we infuse a cow with labeled amino acid traces, and we've done that now several times over the last 20 years. The cow incorporates those labeled amino acids in the milk. We extract the milk by simply milking the cow. We extract that protein. We end up with milk powder or whey or casein, whatever we want to do with it. And then we use it in clinical experiments to see how much of 20 grams protein is actually digested, absorbed over time, and used to stimulate muscle protein synthesis. And because we use traces both intravenously in a vein, as well as in the protein, we can actually differentiate between protein synthesis and what happens with the protein that you ingest. Now, that's a long explanation for the point that we wanted to make is to what extent is all the protein that you ingest absorbed within the time frame that we're measuring muscle protein synthesis. And most of the times, there's only two or three studies that did a dose response effect on muscle protein synthesis. And both those studies show that 20 grams of protein, of a high quality protein, either egg or milk protein, stimulates muscle protein synthesis for up to 4 to 6 hours. And after that, there's no further increase if you ingest 40 grams. And that has been the basis that everybody says 20 grams is sufficient to maximize muscle protein synthesis after a meal. Now, what we see is that if you give larger amounts, probably not everything is digested and absorbed within those 4 to 6 hours, depending on how much time you take. So Johan Trommel, and he gets the credits for all of this, he was nagging me for at least 2 or 3 years to do a study with 100 grams of protein. And I said, like Jorn, I mean, I'm interested from a conceptual point of view, but nobody's interested because we're never going to advise people to ingest 100 grams of protein. Now, we ended up still doing the study because the conceptual studies are, of course, much more fun than the more practical applicable studies. So we provided 25 and 100 grams of protein. And what we see within a few hours, those 100 grams are by far not digested and absorbed. And if we continue to measure muscle protein synthesis, we see that the anabolic response is much greater if you measure over a longer period of time. And then the 100 grams does give a greater response than the 25 grams.
So when you say greater anabolic response, meaning you've got people...
increase in muscle protein synthesis over a more prolonged period of time, ending up of more protein being synthesized over that time frame.
So all things being equal, two different people, same resistance exercising protocol, they eat 25 versus 100 grams. The person eating 100 grams will see more anabolic response.
Yes.
And so there's more anabolic response for consuming more protein. But how much, you know, we talked about oxidized amino acids before, how much are you still wasting most of that extra 75 grams, or is most of it actually getting used?
No, we actually did not see a massive increase that could have been hypothesized by some people, that you get a disproportionate increase in protein oxidation. We didn't see that.
And can you remind us, so what type of people were you, what kind of subjects did you have in the study? Were they healthy, normal, individuals? Were they bodybuilders? What kind of people were these?
No, we typically don't do bodybuilders because you have no idea what they are taking, of course, and what they are doing. So these are all healthy adults. Let me double check what their age was. I think in the range of, think we do too many studies.
Okay, but like normal healthy adults, there wasn't anything. It's not some very special pool of people. And so when you give them 100 grams of protein at a time, is that, did you say this was like a protein powder? Are they drinking like a milkshake here? How exactly are they consuming that?
Yeah, that's just milk protein and then dissolved in the same amount of volume of water. So it's actually a huge amount of protein.
And so using these tracers, you can measure the amino acids in their body at multiple time points for a number of hours after they ingest this. What was the resistance training they did? When did they do it relative to the samples that you took, and how intensive was it?
Lot of questions there. So we had 36 healthy, recreationally active young men. So these are basically students, all healthy. They are used of doing exercise, but not necessarily being like gym rats, being in a gym every day. We made them do some whole body exercise, but the focus lies on leg exercise. So leg press, leg extension, but we also did chest press and lat pull downs. So we like to activate the full body, but of course, as we're measuring muscle protein synthesis in the legs, we always just focus most of it on the legs. And I think what we normally do is like 3 to 6 sets or something like that. I think, let's see here, for every exercise, 10 submaximal repetitions for familiarization, and then 3 to 6 repetitions. Oh, that's the 1 RM. So I think about 4 or 5 sets for every exercise. So it's about half an hour to 45 minutes of resistance exercise. And then we ingest the protein. Oh, we take a biopsy first. And then we ingest the protein. I think it was about 800 mils of water. So that's basically a cycling bottle, 1.5. And then we have muscle biopsies at, and there's actually quite a lot of them, at 0, 240, 480, and 720 minutes. So that's 12, even up to 12 hours after. And so that allows us to do the acute ingestion, digestion, absorption, and that is over the 4 hour period. So that's the 240 minutes. And then we go to double that amount. So that's 8 hours, 480 minutes. Then basically the 25 grams is completely digested and absorbed. And then we go all the way to the 12 hours. And then we actually see that it's way clear that nearly all of the amino acids have been released in the circulation. Also with the 100 grams, but at the 100 grams, we still see some amino acids being released in the circulation. But it clearly shows you that after the 4 hours, you still have a lot of the amino acids being released. So if you would have cut off the protein synthesis at say 2 hours or 4 hours, you don't get the full picture. And that's of course a problem that a lot of people make because we measure response for 4 or 6 hours and that's it. The reason why we do this in studies is, of course, has a reason because with every meal is typically followed up by the next meal within 4 to 6 hours. So that's why most of us do studies with a 4 to 6 hour postprandial evaluation. But we don't know what happens with the first meal having effect on the second meal having effect on the third meal, and then the overnight response. And so what we did see in our studies with the intrinsic labeled protein, that often the digestion and absorption completely, if you go, for example, with meat, because we've also done stuff with labeled meat and also with full meals, then of course the digestion and absorption takes a lot more than those 4 hours. even more, way more than 6 hours. So now we're coming on undiscovered territory, is how long should we measure after a meal? And then somebody can say like, oh, no, for now on, let's all measure everything 12 hours after a meal. But that's also not a normal situation, because people do not fast for 12 hours after a single meal, because probably they already had two meals in those 12 hours. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know too much about meal on meal on meal effect.
I see.
And this is basically one step in that direction. And of course, the problem is with influencers and YouTube and everything, that this study, we got so much attention, basically people saying like, oh, we should ingest 100 grams because that has a greater response. That is nothing. This study is not purposely making suggestions towards the preferred ingestion of protein. This is a conceptual study to understand that digestion and absorption can take longer than 4 to 6 hours. Mm-hmm. And so we need to follow through in how a single meal affects a second meal and a third meal, and how that translates in the long term to muscle maintenance, health, digestion and absorption, anabolic signaling, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like, in other words, you know, if you're eating three meals a day, which many people do, and they're evenly spaced out, even if you were eating identical meals, same grams of food, same macronutrient profile, same amount of protein, everything, you would probably have different physiological responses to each meal, because some of the effects are stacking on top of each other and interacting with the previous meal.
Exactly. And we don't know exactly how these things work, because I mean, some people suggest that protein synthesis switches off after a certain period of time, and that it doesn't happen, that doesn't happen when you do exercise or not. So this study was exercise. So there's a huge amount of questions that are still there, and everybody has a suggestion, of course, but we simply don't know what happens.
Mm-hmm. The changes in amino acids that you see at these various time points, they presumably don't just have to do with protein synthesis and building muscle and things. One of the things that I saw was interesting, and this is a little bit more of a detail, but it really jumped out to me, is you've got three conditions: 100 grams of protein, 25 grams of protein, 0 grams of protein. When you give people 0 grams of protein, there's actually some change in some of these amino acids. And I'm wondering what's going on there. So, for example, it looks like there's an increase in alanine concentrations in the plasma, even when you're not consuming protein. So what are some of these responses to 0 grams of protein in the diet that lead to these amino acid changes?
Yeah, of course, it's not an effect of not ingesting protein, but it is an effect of being in a fasted state. So if you're fasting, you'll actually have an effect on protein breakdown. You'll have an effect on gluconeogenesis. You have an effect on the relationship between fat and carbohydrate oxidation, and all of these things have effect on your amino acid metabolism as well, of course.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, so you're going to get changes in circulating amino acids in a fasted state because your body is using some of those amino acids to get energy and other stuff. Interesting. Are you guys doing any follow-up work on like this type of study? I imagine this is quite a laborious study to do. It's you know, hours and hours of time. You got to convince people to do biopsies.
This was really an annoying study. And I think if Jorn ever hears this, he'll be laughing because, Luke, can we measure this? And I said, yes, we can, but everything costs a lot of money. So it's ridiculous the amount of analysis that we've done in here, because sometimes, or most of the times, we actually focus on one specific tracer to answer one specific question. Now, in this study, and he was very smart in that, every time he asked me for something else, and then he would wait for 2 or 3 weeks, and then he would ask for something else. So in the end, we did way too many analysis in this study. So here we've measured everything. That is probably not something that we're easily going to do again. But I think a few conceptual questions are now out there is what happens with one meal on the other meal. I think that is something that we have to pick up. And also, how long is and under what conditions is the muscle sensitive to the amino acid-induced stimulation of muscle protein synthesis? Because is the second meal, has that still the same effect as the first meal? Is that dependent on circulating amino acids, or is the time-dependent effect? all of these questions, those are studies that we're now thinking about. And one part is nicely that we can nicely do that with intrinsically labeled protein, but some other studies might be simply done with free amino acids or even amino acid infusions to go back to the more basic stuff. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, I mean, the of course, the most difficult studies, not technically, is to see what the long-term effects of changes in your diet are. And those are things that we're also doing, for example, with plant-based diets. One study that I can mention here is, for example, we have adapted people to a high and a low protein intake diet, coming back to another question you just had. And then low and high, in this case, 0.75 grams of protein per kilogram body mass per day, or 1.5. So most people will not say that's very high or very low, but 0.75 is low and 1.5 is high in my perspective. And then we actually looked at how that affects your response to a single meal after adapting to either a low or a high. Now is the interesting finding. We saw that the gut actually contained less protein on the low protein diet. So on the low protein diet, adapting to a low protein diet, the gut became less greedy. So from the same amount of protein, more was released into the circulation. So there's also some habituation effect playing a role here. So the body adapts to the certain amount of protein we consume and redistributes it throughout the body. And I think it's amazing how the gut, and I'm not sure whether the gut actually thinks himself, herself, mm-hmm. or whether it's the peripheral organs downstream that basically shout to the gut like, hey, give us more protein because we're not getting enough here. Mm-hmm. So there seems to be a re-regulation of homeostasis in the amount of amino acids from a single meal that an organ takes.
It sounds like you are doing work looking at plant versus animal proteins and how effectively, you know, our bodies can actually utilize those. That's a huge topic. And you know, you've mentioned, and I've talked with people about this before, that obviously different protein sources, they're not all created equal. You can eat 50 grams of protein from over here, 50 from over here. It's going to have a different profile of amino acids. It's going to have a different level of digestibility and absorbability. Are there any general rules there that are generally going to apply when people are thinking about sourcing their protein at the supermarket?
You know, with the plant-based proteins, I was surprised. So we thought that, so first we worked with protein isolates. So corn protein, soy protein, pea protein. And then we thought that if you give 30 grams of that protein, you see a lesser response than an equivalent amount of dairy protein. And we've seen that before for gluten, for example. Other labs have shown that from soy. And so we started giving 30 grams of protein isolates of a plant origin and compared it to dairy protein. We saw no difference. So 30 grams of protein was either way enough to compensate for lesser quality, because you can compensate for lesser quality by greater quantity. And if we give 30 grams of protein isolates from a plant source, even if that is if they are deficient to a certain amino acid, we see no impact on the postprandial stimulation of muscle protein synthesis.
And that was protein isolate. So do you mean like a powder?
A powder, those protein powders. Now, so those studies didn't show a difference. And we thought like, oh, so in a single meal, also a deficiency in a specific amino acid doesn't have a massive impact, negative impact on muscle protein synthesis. There could be two explanations. One, that 30 grams is enough to compensate for any lesser quality. Or secondly, that there's already enough of that specific amino acid that is deficient in the protein circulating around the human body. Two possible explanations. So we wanted to take it one step further and just look at a more practical way. But of course, most scientists, including myself, we don't like to go to the practical way because then there's a lot of unclarities and insecurities. Mm-hmm. So what we did is we provided subjects, the same subjects crossover, with exactly the same meal. The same meal with regarding the energy content and protein content. But one meal completely vegan, So a very balanced meal with all kinds of plant-based foods. So no protein powders, but whole foods in the food whole foods matrix versus a typical old school Dutch meal, piece of meat, potatoes, veggies, and some apple juice. Now, that meal with the meat actually saw a robust increase in muscle protein synthesis. With the vegan meal, we didn't see any response. Now, everybody will actually say like, oh man, he's promoting animal-based foods. No, I'm not, because I see a lot of benefits in a more plant-based diet. But it was obvious that there was an attenuated increase in circulating amino acids. And of course, that is a huge factor in driving the anabolic response to feeding. Does that mean that the vegan food is not stimulating muscle protein synthesis? Not within the time frame that we assessed. Now, we're following this up over 10 days to see whether we apply this in a full diet, whether it also actually minimizes muscle protein synthesis. Mm-hmm. Now, these studies are undergoing, and we're doing those. But of course, you don't have a very nice comparison anymore, because then you have protein throughout the day, you have meal-on-meal-on-meal effect.
Yep.
And of course, when you go for a vegan diet, a lot of people start eating meat replaces or meat alternatives. And of course, many of those are made from protein isolates. And so the digestibility is less of an issue there.
Hmm. Okay, so you had two types of meals. One was strictly plant-based. It was a vegan meal. One was an omnivorous diet. It had meat and veggies and other things. They were matched for protein, grams of protein. They were matched for total calories. But then, of course, you know, all of the other things are going to differ between them, all the different, the overall nutrient profile. In principle, how do you think about what accounts for the difference here? Is it the digestibility of the physical protein contained in the foods? Is it the presence or absence of other nutrients that affect digestibility and absorbability? All of that stuff?
It's a combination of everything, of course, but I think the fact that we didn't see the difference in the plant-based proteins and even the plant-based protein blends, we saw a perfect response. So if you take the plant-based protein isolates with 30 grams, it was fine. But then when we provided that as whole foods, there was an issue. So I assume that most of it is due to the reduced digestibility, the less bioavailability of these plant-based whole foods for the human body. And that is anti-nutritional factors. Yeah. I mean, fibers can be regarded anti-nutritional factors, but I think they're very important nutritional factors.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate term because it implies they're bad, but that's not necessarily.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so interesting. So you give this omnivorous meal, meat, potatoes, other things, you see the protein synthesis response. You don't see that with the whole food, entirely plant-based vegan diet. But you told us before about those experiments you did with plant-based isolates. And so essentially what you're saying is what's plausibly happening here is the isolates, the powders, it's sort of pre-digested. But if you have these whole foods, the protein, the amino acids are bound up physically in a way that our bodies just are unable to absorb.
And most of the guidelines on a vegan diet actually include that you might want to compensate for the lower digestibility of the protein in your plant-based foods by consuming more protein. Mm-hmm. So you see that in various countries, there's advice that if you follow a vegan diet, that you actually consume more protein than advised on a partially animal-based diet.
Mm-hmm. Is it just in terms of just overall health and making sure that your body hits its nutritional requirements to be a basic healthy person, not necessarily a bodybuilder or an Olympic athlete or anything, just a normal person who's in good health. There's obviously lots of confusion out there. There's lots of opinions out there. People get almost religious with their beliefs in this diet versus that diet, this routine versus that routine. Are there particular axes of variation that you think are better to think along first for people? So for example, is it good to think in terms of whole foods versus processed foods? Is it useful to think about plant versus animal? Is it useful to think about, you know, there's many different axes of variation here. Are there one or two that you think are going to be very useful for most people to think about?
I think the most important thing is keep thinking. And sometimes when people become beliefs, people don't think about it anymore. So we get the strangest responses to publications or from studies that we do. And they say like, hey, you think that the meal with meat does better than a vegan meal. So you must be supporting plant-based or animal-based foods. But then they forget that there's also a study with plant-based proteins where we show no differences. So just don't make it into a belief, but think about it. If you ingest proteins from a plant-based diet on whole foods, do understand that your body is not capable of getting all that protein out. So if you want to compensate for that, either eat more or eat some animal-derived proteins on top of that. If you have a plant-based diet, is it more important to actually be more to have more different foods in your diet? Of course, because some of the plant-based foods are deficient in specific amino acids. Actually, if you combine them, you are less likely to have deficiencies. To be honest, I think I spent probably 30 million euros of research money in nutritional research. And most of the things that I've actually provided clinical proof of is that my mom was always right. And it's pretty amazing. I mean, we have provided clinical evidence that you should eat three times a day with different macronutrients, with sufficient protein, that protein is actually delivered on the right spot if you are physically active between the meals, and might also be good to have some milk and cookies before going to bed. And if you eat, sit upright and chew well. That's about the legacy of all the work that my group has done over the last 25 years.
What do you mean it might be good to have milk and cookies before bed?
Yeah, that's just because some people, but we've done some work on overnight muscle protein synthesis. And so we had some discussions on whether your gastrointestinal tract actually processes protein. And so what we did is we provided this intrinsically labeled protein through a nasogastric tube in the gut while people were sleeping. And this was a really cool study in older adults. So these older adults, they are much more fun to work with than athletes. They call us instead of we call them. They call us every year and say like, look, it's been a year that I've been in the lab. Don't you have a cool study that I can contribute to? And then I tell them like, you know what? You come over next week. We put a nasogastric tube down your gut. We take a muscle biopsy. We make you sleep in the lab. Then we tiptoe into the lab at 2 o'clock, put 40 grams of intrinsically labeled protein that is heated in your gut without waking you up. And in the morning, I'll wake you up with a muscle biopsy at 7 o'clock. And then they say, where can I sign up? It's wow. Really amazing. But what that study showed is that while you sleep, your gut actually digests the protein. We see with retractable lines, we see those amino acids being released into the circulation. And in the morning, we see the conversion of that protein to muscle. Now, strangely enough, when we published that study, I got phone calls from coaches all over the world asking me where they could get those nasogastric lines. That was a bit weird. Because that was a conceptual study to show that if you ingest protein before you go to sleep, that it's normally digested, absorbed, and might help recovery throughout overnight and stimulate muscle loss. So I had to explain these guys that you don't have to use nasogastric tubes for your athletes, but simply have a protein-rich snack in the evening, which most athletes nowadays do, because yeah. That's one of the 4 or 5 meals that they ingest. In the early days, bodybuilders actually put their alarm clock at 3 o'clock to get some protein in.
Oh, well, I guess if we think about the study that we went over in detail today, they might potentially also have the same effect if they simply eat a very large protein rich meal as dinner.
Probably, yes. But I don't know whether 2 meals separately would be better than 1 large meal. Yeah. We haven't discovered that, of course. But I mean, sometimes the sports studies get a lot more attention or the application in sports. But for this study, we were actually looking at elderly people going for elective surgery for a new hip or new knee. Mm-hmm. Because what happens in the hospital, I'm not sure whether you've ever been in hospital admitted.
Not for any significant length of time, no.
Okay, so you get there, you around 5 or 6, you get your dinner. And then your next meal is the next day, say 9 o'clock in the morning. Mm. So we know if you're 15 to 17 hours in an overnight fasted state, you're actually losing muscle. So if you're in a situation where you can't eat enough, you actually have a fever or you just had surgery, you want to minimize the muscle loss during that period.
Yes,
so
yes.
So we would like to see people to have at least another small meal in the evening, just like an athlete would, because being sick is like playing professional sports. That's what we all say. So the whole study was to see whether if we give all the people in the hospital a protein-rich snack in the evening, whether they can use it, whether they can digest it, and whether it helps them to recover. So that was the purpose of the study. And we know that people in the hospital are underfed, even the relatively healthy patients that are coming in for elective self-chosen surgery. Now, we followed up with stuff that we also do, but which is not our core business, is simply seeing whether giving, for example, cheese cubes, which is a typical Dutch treat in the past, if you give them at night as a protein-rich snack, whether that increases protein intake in patients throughout the day during their hospital admission. And it works. It actually increases it by 20%, and not pushing that protein in, but just allowing them or making some cheese available in the evening. Doesn't have to be cheese, can be quark, can be meat, can be sausage, whatever. I don't care. Can be plant-based, but a protein-rich snack in the evening would be best for every patient that is being hospitalized and who otherwise would not eat for 15 hours. So those are the basics why we do these studies. And now we're seeing that the hospital is actually taking this on, and now people are getting food in the evening.
Yeah. I mean, imagine that would also be very important in general for anyone who's elderly or even middle-aged, where, you know, you really want to preserve that muscle late in life.
Yes, but then only eating, and that's the other question that you can come from this study, because simply giving everybody 100 grams of protein obviously doesn't make them very lean and muscular, because you also have to do some physical activity and exercise.
Yeah.
But the combination of the two is great. So if we can actually get patients in the hospital, but also frail elderly, to be more active in between the meals, then the same amount of protein will have a greater effect. Mm-hmm. And if we can also give them a meal in the evening so they're not 15 or more hours being fasted, that could be a major effect on their recovery and functional capacity.
So I just want to ask one follow-up on some of this. You said, so if you're doing daily intermittent fasting, if you're not eating for 15, 16 hours or more, by the time you get to that 15, 16 hour mark, you will be losing muscle mass.
In those 15 hours, you will be in a negative protein balance.
Okay, so you'll at least be at the beginning of your body starting to take some of the amino acids from the muscle in order to utilize them elsewhere.
Yes, but what I already said, that is something that is happening continuously anyway.
Yep.
Because your muscle turns over 1% to 2% per day, so you're constantly releasing amino acids anyway. The more important thing is, are you actually using that time beyond the eating to also synthesize? I mean, if you do intermittent fasting without being physically active, I think you would have a bigger problem.
I see. Yeah. It's the key. It's the feeding pattern interacting with the physical activity pattern.
So I wasn't born in the US, but I always liked seeing the quotes by Jack LaLanne, and especially in the 50s, where he had his TV show to stimulate people from doing exercise. And if you ever get a glimpse of what he did in those years, it was great. But he always had a saying like, if exercise is king and nutrition is queen, together you have a kingdom. And mm-hmm. I love that quote, because that's actually the two things that makes things combine. The synergistic effect is essential to muscle maintenance.
Well, I mean, you've already shared so much information. I love reading your work. I've been following you for a couple of years now. This is the second time you've been on the podcast. I loved having you on the first time, and I definitely wanted to get you back. Is there anything you want to reiterate or any final thoughts you want to leave people with before we sign off today?
Yeah, I don't know whether I said that last time. I mean, I think it's still incomprehensible how the muscle works, but we've started now looking at all these other tissues. We started, of course, with ligaments and bone and cartilage, but we've also ended up measuring protein turnover in the human brain a few years ago. I'm still struggling to understand how this all works, because the human brain has a turnover rate that is 3 times as high as muscle.
Wow. So yeah, if you think about all of the protein in the synapses, like all of that information is turning over constantly.
Yeah, so I mean, of course, there might be proteins in the brain that have a slow turnover, and there might be proteins that have a high turnover. So we measure mixed proteins. So we take, in this case, there was over surgery with people with severe epilepsy. We took, I mean, the surgeons took brain tissue out. We asked these patients, who were great to work with, to be honest. They said, like, okay, feel free to have some of that tissue and put that in a tracer infusion prior to surgery, and we'll look at it. And so then you see that if all the proteins turn over at the same rate that we measured, you have basically a new brain in 3 weeks. So even everything in your brain, and I'm just thinking, like, how does that work? Do your memories, your personality also gets refurbished constantly? And how does that work? And if you
are you familiar with the literature on memory reconsolidation?
Yeah. I mean, that fits with the fact that you can actually just get your memories just refurbished, and of course not always in the correct way, so that things change. I mean, fits with that theory of refurbishment. But of course, we also know that, for example, for students learning for med school or the taxi drivers in London, that we actually see with MRI, you see plasticity in the brain. But I had never seen it in the same way that I am looking at muscle. And of course, this might not be a surprise for a neuroscientist that work on this, because it's not my field, of course. But we also had neuroscientists responding to that publication by saying, like, hey, we don't believe it, because we know from carbon-14 in tissues that there's less turnover in the brain. Now, we've recently actually sent off some brain tissue to somebody that measures carbon-14, and actually confirms that we don't see any carbon-14, even when people were born just before or during all the atomic testing. So the brain definitely has that turnover, but the same goes for your pancreas, your liver, your everything. And it's amazing how your muscle is using amino acids from your brain and from your kidney, and it's constantly doing this. The sheer fastness and the dynamics of metabolism is mind crushing.
All right. Well, Dr. Luke Van Loon, fascinating stuff. Thanks again for joining me a second time, and hope to talk to you again in the future.